I'm Ryan Vasquez, APR News in Birmingham.
Pat Duggins, APR News at the Smithsonian in Washington.
For APR News, I'm Jeremy Loeb in Tuscaloosa.
Maggie Martin, APR News in Muscle Shoals.
I'm Stan Ingold, APR News in Selma.
Authorities are investigating a UPS plane crash near Birmingham Shuttlesworth International Airport this morning. The cargo plane crashed a few minutes before 5 a.m. There is a residential area near the crash site, but it doesn't appear to be affected by the crash.
I hear a really strong explosion, and I saw the flash.
Peter Torres fixes airplanes for a living. He's a mechanic at the Civil Air Patrol at Birmingham Shuttlesworth International Airport. He says what he heard Wednesday morning was a plane beyond help.
The aircraft touched the one block away from my place, touched the wires, the electrical wires. Very possible was the landing gear, and them dive all the way down to the ground.
The crash got Robert Walker out of bed, too, indirectly. His neighbors started calling him just before 5 a.m. It wasn't to talk about what they saw.
A lot of them didn't hear the crash or see the crash, but they could smell. They were concerned about the smell.
That smell was jet fuel. Peter Torres is familiar with it. He says he gets a whiff every time he works near an aircraft.
And I hate that smell because it makes me dizzy. But the jet fuel is similar like kerosene.
What residents north of the airport heard, saw, and smelled was a United Parcel Service cargo plane crashing just short of the runway. C.W. Martis saw it firsthand. He's a battalion chief with the Birmingham Fire Department and the local fire marshal.
Absolutely. It's a debris field probably stretching a block and a half of debris packages, plane wreckage, things of that nature.
The National Transportation Safety Board has found no evidence of a fire or engine failure before the crash. They will soon begin their review of the flight recorders from the UPS Airbus A300. NTSB board member Robert Sumwalt says it took investigators around 3 hours to locate the recorders.
They were covered in hardened plastic, metal, and cargo. And they, as many of you have seen the tweeted pictures, they were blackened and sooted. And we are cautiously optimistic that we will be able to obtain good data from those recorders.
Sumwalt says they should know sometime this week whether or not.
Members of the Eastlake Homeowners Association want answers tonight from the City of Birmingham, the local airport authority, and the Red Cross. Residents evacuated their homes following the crash. The concern was over jet fuel from the wreckage of the Airbus A300. The group's president, Robert Walker, says there was no support from the city or the Red Cross for people displaced by the accident, many of whom couldn't afford to leave.
Some people just had to deal with the eye irritation, the coughing, and the like.
Walker says residents also want to ask about flight paths that take large jet planes over their homes during final approach to Birmingham.
Today, Mason Davis is an accomplished lawyer in Birmingham. But in 1958, he was just a young law student trying to register to vote in Alabama.
The registrars asked me to explain the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. I started talking and none of them knew what I was talking about. And they ultimately allowed me to become a registered voter.
While the line of questioning struck Davis as odd, it made him also worry what they were asking other potential black voters.
What do you think they were asking people who were not law students? They would ask questions on the literacy test. Some so outrageous as, tell the number of jelly beans in this jar.
Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The measure made it illegal to ask voters to pass any test before casting a ballot. Now, almost 50 years later, Shelby County in Alabama is challenging the constitutionality of one part of the act.
The set of explosions rattled windows in the city of Mobile, Alabama. It was so powerful that residents in the town of Spanish Fort say they felt the blast 10 miles away. The U.S. Coast Guard says the two natural gas barges were at the Australian-owned Austal shipyard when the fire broke out. The blast was reportedly visible from Interstate 10, which connects Mobile to Pensacola, Florida on the east and Biloxi, Mississippi to the west. At least three people are reported injured.
Last night we came together in one of the buildings on campus and had about 50 people there, and we literally just called, texted, sent messages on Facebook, email. We did everything that we possibly could to get the word out.
honestly can say that I don't know people who are downright racist, but they're just scared to go into the unknown. And I think it's really great that now we have the opportunity to come together to move forward so there isn't that fear of what's going to happen, because it is hard to make the first step. And it's a shame that it took this long, but it's exciting that it's finally happening.
Just a few weeks ago, some of the brave sorority women that are standing with us today showed us on campus how to open our hand. That a few students can enact change and can get everyone here, can get the New York Times here, can change the world. We stand here today to honor that commitment, but it needs to be a continued effort. We can no longer allow campus to close our hand. I want all of you to stand with us and continue this commitment. Woo!
The Wright brothers made their famous flight at the Outer Banks of North Carolina in 1903. By 1910, they were building and selling their airplanes. Jacob says the purchase price included the aircraft as well as piloting lessons from a member of the Wright brothers' exhibition team.
And to create the exhibition team, they had to get a stable of flyers. And they went down to Montgomery, Alabama in March of 1910 and were there until the early part of May, and train the first five flyers who would be the exhibition pilots for the Wright exhibition team.
In other words, the Wright brothers helped create civil aviation, and they did it in Alabama.
Check, check, check. Test 1, 2. Hey, hey. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be starting our program in about 5 minutes. If you can make your way to your seats, please.
Dignitaries and onlookers grabbed what shade there was in Montgomery's mid-morning heat as the city remembered its connection to the Wright brothers. The event included a master of ceremonies and, of course, an opening joke.
Mom always told me, two wrongs do not make a right. And then she'd ask me, son, do you know what two rights make? I'd shake my head, and she'd say an airplane.
30-year-old Andrew Lackey was convicted in the 2005 Halloween night beating and shooting death of 80-year-old Charles Newman in the victim's home in Limestone County. Lackey is scheduled to die by lethal injection. He dropped his appeals and fired his legal team and even wrote letters and took the witness stand to request that his execution date be set. After meeting with family members earlier this week, Lackey was moved to a holding cell near the death chamber at Holman Prison in Atmore. He will also be the first prisoner in Alabama executed in nearly 2 years.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
This movie trailer for The Wolf of Wall Street is meant to whet the appetite of the ticket-buying public. But the story of Jordan Belfort, who was indicted on securities fraud for stock market manipulation and running a penny stock boiler room, is painfully true.
When they formed the company, and the company itself, Stratton Oakmont and those others, had all these shares that they paid a penny for.
Joe Borg is director of the Alabama Securities Commission.
So when they built up the frenzy and they got up to $5, $10, and they sold it all, and then they quit, well, guess what happened to the value of the company? There was no more interest, and it collapsed back down to pennies.
This kind of scheme is called a pump and dump, and this real-life incident cost investors close to $200 million. Borg formed a multi-state task force that led to the prosecution of Belfort's company after his office was inundated with complaints. Now that he's out of prison, Belfort wrote a memoir called The Wolf of Wall Street, which was turned into a movie.
If we're going to glorify, The Wolf of Wall Street, maybe Cockroaches of Wall Street would be better, I don't know.
Trim Tab is one of the newest kids on the block in Alabama's brewing industry, and they're still getting their act together. Still, company founder Harris Stewart says he's on a much different path than he originally planned.
I had just been a home brewer for about 7 years, lived up in Asheville, North Carolina, just fell in love with brewery culture. Really about 2.5 years ago was when I started plotting the business plan and just starting to put everything together. I was in law school and those clothes just didn't quite fit right. I found out I was brewing beer more than I was studying torts.
We're standing in the open room that represents Stewart's field of dreams. He says a lot of work has already gone into setting up.
Really started putting pen to paper, building the team, starting to raise money because we knew the scale of the project that we wanted to do. It was going to have to be a team approach.
Alabama coach Nick Saban and Notre Dame's Brian Kelly agree on one thing. Both schools may have football history dating back a century, but that doesn't count when you have college-age players in the national spotlight. Saban says keeping his team focused takes work.
Well, believe me, being around young people, being in games like this, that's something. And it's something big.
Notre Dame's Brian Kelly says the long period between the last regular game of the season and tonight's title matchup doesn't help.
It's the anticipation of the game because there's such a lead up for this one. You're a little bit more anxious because you want to see your team play again. It's been such a long time.
The Crimson Tide and Notre Dame face off at Sun Life Stadium tonight for the BCS Championship. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Fort Lauderdale.
I'm just excited to see us play our best against the best team in the nation.
That's how Notre Dame senior Joe DiBenedetto felt going into last night's BCS title game.
It's just, oh my gosh, it would just be... It would make my life if we win this national championship.
McCarron's pass complete to number 9, Amari Cooper.
But it wasn't to be. Alabama scored on its very first drive and just kept on going. Notre Dame got 2 touchdowns, but it wasn't enough to keep up with the barrage of points by Bama. It wasn't all smooth sailing. Over 80,000 spectators crowded Sun Life Stadium for last night's BCS title game. Not every Crimson Tide fan in attendance was a graduate of the University of Alabama. Take Rodney Scammon, for example.
The funny thing is, I'm from Chicago, and I was rooting for you guys today. You guys won, came through the way I wanted you to, and it was great.
He just doesn't like Notre Dame. However, a close buddy of his does. John Moran of New York City walked up wearing his Fighting Irish jersey.
Notre Dame is coming back. And we want to face you guys again.
Alabama's victory last night represents the first back-to-back BCS titles for quarterback A.J. McCarron and coach Nick Saban. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Fort Lauderdale.
January 22nd, 1983. Dear Jason, thank you very much for sharing the poem you had written. You are a smart young man for a fifth grader, and I hope you will continue to work hard and come to Bama someday. Best wishes to you and your family and your classmates at Berry Elementary. Sincerely, Paul Bryant. Friends wanted to touch the letter. Everyone wanted to see if it was real, wanted to see if it was his handwriting. There were people, I'm sure, that just wanted to touch a piece of paper that maybe Coach Bryant had touched. And I knew that my mother would be picking me up later that afternoon. Couldn't wait to show her. And I remember getting to the car, opening up the door, sitting inside, and seeing tears down my mother's face. And at that moment, she just looked at me, and I told her, I said, Mom, look, I have a letter from the bear. And she looked at me and said, Son, the bear died today.
All year long on Alabama Public Radio, we'll be looking back on some pivotal moments in the civil rights movement.
For me, it was just a day of resolve and resolution. And I said, "I'm sign me up."
Well, the first thing is, you know, I told them that I went to jail. And their first reaction was like, ooh, grandmama. You know, I was like, well, let me explain.
It was just, you knew that God was on your side. And we knew that it didn't matter what we were facing. If God's on your side, you'll overcome it.
James Stewart, Eloise Gaffney, and Washington Booker are all in their early 60s. They're all from Birmingham. They're all African American. And 50 years ago, they made national news.
American Airlines presents Douglas Edwards with the late news.
In Birmingham, Alabama, the civil rights demonstrators became wholesale today, and police arrested more than 450 Negro schoolchildren who played hooky to parade and picket and pray.
On May 2nd, 1963, Stewart, Gaffney, and Booker were among the teenagers who took part in what became known as the Children's March. It was a protest against racial segregation in Birmingham. If you ever saw the black and white film footage of Negro protesters being met with fire hoses and police dogs, that's it.
Police loaded some of the school children onto school buses, arresting, among others, a 6-year-old girl. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth says the demonstrations will continue until we run out of children.
I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
It was mean, and we lived through it.
Eloise Gaffney.
And when I tell my kids, they still don't. My children find it hard to believe, and my grandchildren, it's really far-fetched, you know. When I say I couldn't go to Fair Park, and I mean, you had to pass by Fair Park and see the kids out there playing. So naturally, the child's like, why I can't go over there, you know? And I'm sure parents then had a hard, hard time answering those kinds of questions.
On May 2nd, 1963, Gaffney would take part in the Children's March. James Stewart did too.
My mother, when I was very young, my mother took me to town and into one of the stores. And there, I had found out by this time that the tall, rectangular water fountains had cold water. And the ones right next to it, which were the porcelain white basin type fountains, had warm water. So there was a stool in front of the tall one. So I got up on the stool and I was about to get the water, drink of cold water. And my mother just came out of nowhere saying, no. And she lunged at me and swept me away. And she started talking to me about what I could and couldn't do. And those rules were hard to comprehend because you had to know what's right and what's wrong and what's white.
Gaffney and Stewart would be joined during the Children's March by Washington Booker.
I can remember seeing, some kid with a banana split, a white kid sitting at the counter, a big old banana split. And, I mean, I don't know. I had nothing to compare it to and how it looked. It was just a marvelous thing, and I wanted one. I wanted to sit there at that counter and eat one. And I always thought about that. During the marches, when we demonstrate, I would think about that. I want to be able to sit at that lunch counter. Yeah, so I can order me one of them banana splits. It seems trivial, but it was a part of the way you understood the world.
Birmingham area teenagers who took part in the 1963 Children's March say local disc jockey Shelley the Playboy signaled the start of the protest, but he didn't organize it. The credit for that goes to a lieutenant of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend James Bevel. One of the students he inspired was James Stewart.
He wore one of the blue jean suits with badges from everybody and all over the little pins all over him. And he was bald headed and he wore a little skull cap. And he's the one who was kind of the kid's Pied Piper. And he talked to us about getting involved. So it was accumulation of things. And we just reached a point where we said, you know, we don't care. We've got to do something to change this.
And that's where Birmingham area disc jockey Shelley the Playboy Stewart comes in. James Bevel also wanted to use local radio stations to get the word out on protest day. He spoke with Shelley as well as another local disc jockey named Paul White. His radio audience knew him as Tall Paul. Shelley says on May 2, 1963, he and Tall Paul announced the beginning of the Children's March. They just did it in a roundabout way. They used codes.
You had to have codes to get into the community. If you said, made an announcement, I want everybody to go to the park. You don't do that. Because remember, there were mothers and fathers who were afraid would lock the doors, and the principals and teachers would lock the doors. So you just went around that. There's, as we say years ago, there's more ways than one to skin a cat. Shake, rattle, and roll. That's an old tune by an artist called Joe Turner. And we say when we play shake, rattle, and roll, that's the signal. Time to go out. So shake, rattle, and roll.
Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Where you get in that kitchen, make some noise with the pots and pans.
And when those kids heard that, they told the teachers, we gone. And the teachers tried to stop them. They were jumping out of windows at Parker High School. They were jumping. So that is really what took place, yes. And it could escalate it, and the police didn't know what to do about it.
I believe you were told you were devil in Nano. Well,
jail was like hell. It was 4 days of really hell.
James Stewart of Birmingham was just a teenager on May 2, 1963. He took part in what became known as the Children's March, and he was one of the first to be arrested and jailed.
We were put in a room probably that could hold 50, 60 people. They put maybe 300 people in that room. There was standing room only. It was a concrete floor, concrete walls, very small windows with the bars on them, and it was extremely hot. And they just kept putting us in that room. We had to develop a system to even sleep. We would make space on the floor, and most of us would stand around the wall or sit in the windows, and those slept on the floor slept on the concrete.
Washington Booker was in that cell, too.
Going to jail didn't, nobody slowed down, broke nobody's spirit. You know, okay, now, we in jail. This is what we supposed to be. This is what we supposed to be doing. Come on, y'all, let's sing. You ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. And we go through, we sing. So it was anything but punishment.
That was on day one of the Children's March. On day two, more protests took place, more arrests were made. But when these students were put behind bars, Booker and Stewart noticed they were soaking wet.
So I was out in the park when they released the fire hoses and the dogs.
Eloise Gaffney.
I was walking along. At that time, it was Fifth Avenue, and it was a whole row of businesses there. And they had glass windows. And, I mean, the water was so forceful that it knocked me into the window. I mean, they were in the park, and this water had come, like, over a block. But guess what? We found fun in it. Some of us just would, you know, lay on the ground and just let the water just push you all across the park. You know, we made a fun thing out of it. You know, of course, some girls, I know one of the girls that were actually bitten by the dogs. So that part was really scary, but the fear just really didn't come. Now when I think about it, I was like, Lord, it had to be the Lord to keep us because we were so crazy we didn't realize the danger.
September 15th, 1963 started off just like any other Sunday for Barbara Cross, with morning Sunday school class down in the basement of 16th Street Baptist Church. Cross remembers that day's Sunday school lesson.
And our Sunday school lesson that day was a love that forgives. I'll never forget that as long as I live. In my class particular, we discuss the scripture from Matthew, the 5th chapter, about talking about agape love, the godly type of love, and agape is the Greek word for godly love.
It was the first time Pastor John Cross, Barbara's father, initiated Youth Sunday under his ministry. After class, the children were getting ready for their other responsibilities that Sunday.
I remember a good friend of mine came by the classroom, and we were going to go to the bathroom together. And my teacher stopped me. My teacher's name was Mrs. DeMann. And she gave me an assignment that literally spared my life and kept me out of harm's way.
Cross was asked to write the names of those who would be moving up to the next age level in Sunday school. It was just a few minutes later that Sunday would soon be marred by an explosion that would change Birmingham forever.
And I remembered I was in the process of writing the names down. The most horrific noise that I had ever heard in my life. I remember the building shaking. I remembered hearing children screaming.
Four young girls died, many more injured, and a community ripped apart by an act of violence on what was supposed to be a peaceful Sunday.
50 years ago, a bomb exploded at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Four young girls were killed in the blast. It would take 14 years before the first Klansman was tried and convicted in the bombing. Robert Chambliss was found guilty of his part in the attack. He wound up here at the St. Clair County Correctional Facility, about 40 miles northeast of Birmingham. It's here where Chambliss wrote letters to his family during his time in prison. The handwritten letters and the pictures they paint from that time can now be found with just a short ride down a creaky elevator to the bowels of the Archives Department at the Birmingham Public Library.
April 20, 1979. Yes, Mommy, you told me you called the governor. Mommy, I ask you again, did you talk to the governor? Did you call my lawyer? What did he say?
Mommy is Chambliss's wife in a letter read by library archivist Jim Baggett.
wrote the governor a nice 2.5-page letter. The reason, he sent the lieutenant governor's staff over here to talk to me. Tell our little Bobby to write one. Put in your letter so it won't cost her postage. Answer soon, your loving husband, R.E. Chambliss.
Bagot has been studying those decade-old letters in detail.
Chambliss is almost entirely focused on himself in his letters. There's a lot of self-pity, and, you know, he presents himself as a victim. And he never acknowledges involvement in the bombings. But, no, there's no remorse. There's no acceptance of responsibility at all.
Let's put you in the position of being a black person living in the South during the Civil Rights Movement.
If you picked up a white newspaper, you as a black person did not exist.
Craig Flournoy is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a professor of journalism at Southern Methodist University.
There was no record of you being born, no record of you graduating from high school, much less college, no record of you getting married, no record of your promotion, and no record of you dying.
In other words, unless you were famous like Joe Louis or Louis Armstrong, a black person might not make it into most white newspapers unless they committed a crime. So when it came to coverage of events surrounding the Civil Rights Movement, there was little, if any, coverage at all. Take the Montgomery bus boycott as an example.
The New York Times basically missed the story.
Again, Craig Flournoy.
They relied on wire service copy for the first 4 months, and the esteemed Johnny Popham, the greatest reporter covering the South during this time, wrote exactly two stories about it.
Hi. Where are y'all from?
Oregon. That's like a long way off.
Yeah, it's a long way off.
Betty and Phil Histon are from Corvallis, Oregon. They're in Alabama like many tourists, to try the local barbecue and to see the sights. However, today's trip has nothing to do with the music scene in Muscle Shoals or the Alabama football coach Bear Bryant in Tuscaloosa. The Histons are at the Civil Rights Interpretive Center in Selma.
We have heard about the Civil Rights Movement since we were children. I wanted to see where some of these things had taken place. It's part of the history that we wanted to see, be part of.
We're on a cross-country trip, and we knew the name Selma, and things happened here, and so we kind of wanted to see where it really happened.
And the Histons are not alone. If you want to see how big civil rights tourism is in Alabama, state tourism officials say look no farther than the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham. The center attracts an estimated 150,000 visitors a year. Lee Sintel is the tourism director for the state of Alabama. He says the business is big enough for three cities to fight over.
There is no agreement in this state as to which city owns the civil rights movement, because people in Montgomery think that everything happened in the Montgomery area. People in Birmingham think that the major events only took place in Birmingham. So Birmingham, Montgomery, and Selma are three cities where more tourists visit because that's where the landmarks are.
Those were the only black students there at the school. And they began as soon as the integration started at 54 and 55.
Sitting in her living room in Georgia, just a few minutes outside of Atlanta, Fannie Motley points to old photographs of the first 9 black students admitted to Spring Hill College. Her picture is on the top. Motley says she was hesitant to attend Spring Hill at first, but her husband insisted.
He said, now that the integration law has passed, and since Spring Hill has opened up its doors, and we right here, said, all you have to do to finish your last 2 years of college, just get in the car and ride out that Spring Hill every day.
Motley wasn't your typical college student. She was 29, married, and had 2 young sons when she transferred to Spring Hill in 1955. That was just a few months after the Jesuit University decided to integrate. In 1955,
they would ask questions on the literacy test, some so outrageous as, tell the number of jelly beans in this jar.
Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The measure made it illegal to ask voters to pass any test before casting a ballot. Now, almost 50 years later, Shelby County in Alabama is challenging the constitutionality of one part of the act. Cam Ward is a state senator representing District 14, which includes Shelby County. He says the issue is over something called preclearance.
Anytime we want to annex someone into our cities, we have to get permission from the Justice Department. Anytime we want to de-annex, change our city lines, we have to get permission from the Justice Department. And that seems extremely overburdensome for one area of the country to have to do it as opposed to another.
Ward thinks the Voting Rights Act has served a valuable purpose and continues to do so. But when it comes to the pre-clearance provision, changes need to be made. He's a supporter of efforts to challenge the act before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Used to be a sundry store right here on the corner to your right there, where this building is.
Hobson City could be easy to miss if you're just passing through. About 2 miles long, the town sits between Anniston and Oxford. The city was once a part of Oxford until an African-American Justice of the Peace was elected from the area. Oxford's mayor redrew the boundaries and kicked out Hobson City. The town was incorporated in 1899 as Alabama's first all-black city.
Nobody thought that it would work because blacks were not used to governing themselves.
Hobson City Mayor Alberta McCrory.
In fact, some of the newspapers referred to it as maybe a project or a test of some kind, and they would wait to see what happened. So here we are, still existing here in Hobson City in 2013.
There's a cross that's not yet burned, but it's placed about where those recycling bins are that really welcome her when the car stops here at the intersection.
Next Tuesday marks 50 years since the stand in the schoolhouse door. That's when Governor George Wallace tried to keep two African-American students from enrolling at the Tuscaloosa campus in 1963. The names of Vivian Malone and James Hood are etched in civil rights history, but they weren't the first.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So things were said to her, things were thrown at her. But think about your day-to-day. What do you do on a daily basis? You walk to classes, right?
He's referring to Authorine Lucy. She enrolled in Tuscaloosa in 1956, 7 years before Malone and Hood. Black says the reception wasn't welcoming.
One of the images there on the next page over, you'll see, is a group of pro-segregationist folks. They're burning in effigy a copy of the Brown v. Board decision.
Lucy lasted 3 days before leaving the campus.
If you've ever been to a high school reunion, they can be a little nerve-wracking. But tonight's gathering at the Tuskegee Human and Civil Rights Multicultural Center has a different vibe. For the former students here, all in their 60s now, it's not so much a reunion as it is a reflection. They're looking back on what was supposed to be the first day of classes on September 2nd, 1963. Former student Willie Wyatt Jr. was one of the 13 black students integrating Tuskegee High School.
I thought, well, okay, there's going to be 300 to 400 other kids in the school. How am I going to make friends? How am I going to be accepted? Is there anything that's going to happen that it's going to cause me to react and respond. So that was kind of the thought running through my head.
But Wyatt never made it to the first day of class. No one did. That's because Alabama Governor George Wallace intervened to stop the school from desegregating. Wyatt vividly remembers what happened that morning.
The school was surrounded by state troopers, and the 13 of us who boarded the bus got to the driveway of the school, and Captain Pryor of the Alabama State Patrol got on the bus and gave us all a copy of an executive order from the governor denying us admission to the school.
It's 8:06. Good morning. I'm Jeremy Loeb, APR News, in for Pat Duggins. Forecasters say Alabama is facing the threat of severe weather over the weekend. The National Weather Service says temperatures will reach near record levels across the state tomorrow as moist air flows north off the Gulf of Mexico. That will be followed by drier air moving in from the west, bringing a chance of strong storms. Forecasters say there's a medium to high chance of severe storms beginning tomorrow night and a low to medium chance of isolated tornadoes through Sunday afternoon. The chances of bad weather are highest in a northwestern third of the state. We'll have more in a few minutes from WVUA's Richard Scott. President Barack Obama issued 21 pardons and commutations yesterday, including 3 cases from Alabama. Alabama Public Radio's Stan Ingold reports former Governor Don Siegelman was not among them.
Siegelman's family and supporters have been trying to get President Barack Obama to help the former governor, who is in federal prison for bribery. The 3 cases from Alabama the president did act on included commuting the life sentence of Clarence Aaron of Mobile so that he will be released in April. Aaron was convicted on drug charges involving cocaine. The president says Aaron and others receiving commutations were sentenced under old drug laws that were unduly harsh. The president granted pardons to Charlie Lee Davis Jr. of Wetumpka and Martin Allen Hatcher of Foley.
Both were convicted of drug crimes and have finished their sentences. Stan Engold, APR News.
The city of Thomasville is one step closer to getting its own hospital. Mayor Sheldon Day told AL.com they took a big step forward with a document called a Certificate of Need. Thomasville's last hospital was the Southwest Alabama Medical Center. It closed in 2011 due to financial constraints. The Certificate of Need allows the town, halfway between Tuscaloosa and Mobile, to officially plan to build the new hospital. They were already approved for a facility with 49 beds. A University of Alabama research team says holiday shoppers need to be especially careful today and tomorrow. The Center of Advanced Public Safety in Tuscaloosa studied traffic crashes around the holidays. The result is that the Friday and Saturday before Christmas are the most dangerous. Dr. Alan Parrish leads the team. He says Christmas has more crashes than Thanksgiving because Thanksgiving travelers are mostly on the interstates.
Highway driving is, in general, a lot safer than you would think. There are fewer accidents on the interstates than what you would typically expect, or at least what most people typically expect.
Parrish says the number of traffic accidents doubles on the Friday and Saturday before Christmas. However, these crashes often occur around shopping malls, so they're low-speed fender benders where fatalities are rare. Now for a look at today's weather, here's WVUA's Richard Scott.
Good Friday to you. Mostly cloudy skies expected today. Temperatures top out the low.